Hi, I'm Dr. Elizabeth Sanders, a foot and ankle surgeon and assistant professor at Boston University Medical Center.
Hi, I'm Katrina Sanders. I'm a registered dental hygienist, consultant, international speaker, and wine lover.
And we're sisters. I grew up looking up to my big sister, Katrina.
And now I look up to my lady boss, physician sister, Elizabeth.
Together, we are working to unite the dental and medical communities in unique and exciting ways.
Welcome to Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters, our monthly podcast,
where we unpack all things health related from your mouth to your toes.
So grab your flossy flops
and slide on some flippy floppies
and let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Floss and Flip Flops with your favorite sisters, the Ginger Sisters. Hello, Ginger Sister. How are you today?
I'm good, Ginger Sister. How are you?
I am good. And you know why? I am so excited. We are getting so close to the end of the year. I can feel it. It is our last episode of 2022. And I'm feeling all the feels as we start like kind of talking about the holidays when we're trading out that pumpkin spice latte for that peppermint mocha and getting ready to, I don't know about you, but I spend a lot of time picking out all the little gifts for the dogs for the holidays and, you know, just getting everything, getting the tree situated and stuffing everybody's stockings and all that jazz. And of course, for all the dental peeps out there, everybody I'm sure is so excited for the perpetual Christmas carols, which begin to get piped into our operatories the day after Thanksgiving and will continue until right before Christmas. So we always get so excited like the first week of December. We're like, oh, yay. And then after like the 12th time of hearing Jingle Bell Rock, we're like, okay, I'm done. So
I mean, I'm a little disappointed fall is over because the pumpkin spice can continue though. Mm-hmm. But I'm very excited for the holidays.
Yes. Yes. Me too. So exciting. So I'm super excited as we wrap up our final episode of the year to give you, what should we call it? Like the 12 systemic diseases to be concerned about, like on the first medical history, your patient said to you, and then we're going to go through the 12 warning signs in your patient's medical history that there's something going on that we need to be quite concerned about.
This was Katrina's idea, by the way, essentially an advent calendar for nerds. That's what we're doing right now. You realize that, right?
You don't get any little fudgy treats, no chocolate, no wine advent calendar for you.
But a little bit of information.
Just a little bit of inflammation rather. Oh, see what I did there? Oh, so I'm super excited. We're going to be unpacking this. I mean, I'm not excited for our patients who have these things on their medical history, but this is, I think, such a neat and concise way for us to kind of weave through the things that we're concerned about. And with this, I want to begin with a quote from Dr. Stephen Lin from his book. If you're anybody who's listening is like a big bookworm and they're super interested in, you know, reading all the geeky things that I like to read, there are probably one or two of you. Dr. Stephen Lin wrote this book. It's called The Dental Diet. And in the book, there's a lot of really interesting, incredible information in it and relatively provocative that really kind of shakes up what we know about our industry. And in this book, he says this quote that I just think is so fantastic. He says, "Oral disease is both a warning and a cause of chronic diseases that can harm the entire body." And I think this is such a powerful statement because, you know, we've spent the past year talking about different oral systemic modalities and, you know, how I see it, these diseases show up in the oral cavity as a dental professional, how you as a medical professional see these things show up in your line of work. And yet the reality is the whole point of us getting together and creating a podcast like this is to create a conversation that is robust, that helps to integrate all layers of, you know, what our patients are experiencing. And so this is where I really think we need to take a step back. When you see oral disease in your patient, we have been trained in the dental space to treat the oral disease. And the reality is the oral disease can oftentimes be a warning that something else is going on. So are we treating the symptom or are we treating the problem? And when we talk about the management of the work that we do in dentistry, dental hygienists particularly are truly trained as preventive specialists. They're the ones that should be well positioned to identify, okay, so we've removed the bacteria and yet we're still not seeing a complete resolution. What's going on? Is there is this a warning sign that something else is happening in the body? And what is my responsibility as a dental professional managing this? On the other side, we also know that oral disease is a cause of chronic diseases. And so, of course, this is where, you know, we also acknowledge if we don't treat this disease process, there is a high likeliness that chronic disease could either begin or could worsen. So this is where I think we have an opportunity to critically look at some of these pieces. And the big warning sign or the big piece that we're going to be looking at during our podcast episode today, the 12 warning signs of inflammation that we can see in our patient's medical history, really point back to risk for cardiovascular disease. And so, you know, this is really where, you know, as we're focusing on a lot of this content today, I want you to consider that some of these pieces are going to be woven into your dental treatment plan. And what I mean by that is if the patient already has oral infection, we know that they have an elevated risk for chronic diseases, particularly cardiovascular disease. So if your patient is sitting in your chair and they have oral disease, they already have an elevated risk for cardiovascular disease. And now let's add on top of that, all of these different conditions that we're going to be talking about today that provide clear indicators that there is some sort of an inflammatory or cardiovascular risk. So without further ado, let's get started, shall we, Dr. Sanders?
Yeah, let's get started. That was fantastic. I'm glad you explained that. And I think, especially since we were just at a conference together, just understanding the link between what can be seen in the mouth, that oral disease can show a warning and cause of a chronic disease. But likewise, you can see a lot. You gave a quote that 27 million Americans will see a dental professional or a dental hygienist and not see their primary care physician, which really
just in 1 year. That's just in 1 year.
That's unbelievable. Which right? It just really demonstrates that you as a dental hygienist and a dental provider just have so much control over maybe diagnosing or telling your patients about some of these signs. And you just put it so well. So let's start, I guess.
Okay. Are you ready for this? I'm gonna start. Hold on. This is what I'm gonna do. I'm going to sing it and then you say it. Okay. That's how we're going to do it. Okay.
This is too exciting.
Okay. On the first day of Christmas, my patient said to me, they have
asthma.
Okay.
That doesn't really work. No.
Asthma. Okay. So let's talk about the first day of Christmas. Your patient comes in with asthma. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. So asthma, we do know that 1 in 10 American children have asthma, and there are direct links between asthma and heart disease. In fact, in a lot of conferences, cardiac physicians, they do talk a lot about asthma because of that direct link, probably because of, and you and I are just very big on talking about inflammation. And we know that cardiovascular disease is the number one cause of death in the United States, and it's a huge burden. So it's something that we should be talking about on a routine basis. And we know that patients who have asthma have a 60% increased risk of having a cardiovascular event. Not only that, patients who are actively
having medications, meaning they're on a nebulizer or they're on an inhaler or they're actively being treated for asthma, have a 60% chance, even more than those asthmatics who are not receiving treatment, to have a heart attack.
So this is crazy because this really leans into what they talk about when it comes to like a multifactorial risk for asthma. So asthmatics do have elevated mast cell activity. We know that. So your mast cells are what release those inflammatory cytokines. Leukotrienes, we know, are a really critical cytokine that's released. They're the ones that cause bronchoconstriction and airway obstruction. So this is what you're talking about, right? When a patient is put on some sort of a nebulizer, you know, some sort of a medicament to reduce the activity of these leukotrienes. But it's interesting because when you talk about steroid use, that then, of course, in turn, just the medications alone can elevate an asthmatic's risk for experiencing a cardiovascular issue, which is just crazy.
Exactly right. And I think a lot of these illnesses, if you talk about a lot of the treatments or the underlying factors that could be causing the actual illness itself, are probably causing this cardiovascular risk itself.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very interesting.
Isn't that crazy? We also, of course, see that asthmatics, you know, depending on if they're dry air or non-dry air, that asthmatics do also have challenges with exercise, you know, aerobic activity, high intensity cardio, et cetera, right? So just based on the lifestyle challenges that an asthmatic may experience, that of course could also be a contributory factor, right?
You're absolutely right. I think a lot of it is the underlying factors. I had a patient that he was 16 years old and he actually says that he's been cured of asthma. So he had asthma kind of all his life as a child, and he underwent respiratory therapy, physical therapy, and certain things to try to get him off of his medications. So I think this is really where I think educating your patient and working with them through the illness to try to get them off that medication is really beneficial. And this is lifestyle changes as well. Getting better sleep, eating better, more physical exercise. So I think that was very interesting.
That's powerful. All right. On the second day of Christmas, your patient said to you, they're undergoing
cancer chemotherapy.
That works. I don't know if we should be like singing that. Yeah, I don't know.
That's true. All right. I'm at work right now. People can hear me probably.
Great. That's even better. They're like, why is Dr. Sanders singing this in her office? cancer chemotherapy, walk us through what we know about cancer chemotherapy and its overall impact on cardiovascular risk.
Well, let's just be straightforward and honest and understand that cancer chemotherapy really has been beneficial for the treatment of cancer. And a lot of cancers have almost been considered to be curable illnesses because of this. However, it is considered cardiotoxic. And a lot of it is because of its increased risk of cardiovascular comorbidity and mortality in people who are receiving this. Probably because, let's say, if you are receiving chemotherapy or radiation therapy around the mediastinal area or around the area of the heart, it could lead to an increased risk of coronary heart disease. It could affect your left ventricular systolic dysfunction, which is then going to lead to a problem throughout the blood vessels throughout your entire body. It could lead to valvular heart disease or even arrhythmias.
And so it's interesting, you know, oftentimes as a hygienist, when I see a patient who is a cancer patient and they are going through chemotherapy, my number one concern is doing a med consult to make sure that I'm not creating bacteremia that can drain on the immune system. You know, just a few months back, we released an episode about pediatric cancer and some of the considerations that we need to integrate there. So, you know, we're concerned about that, but it is interesting when we talk about a patient who's actually receiving active therapy, for cancer, that the drugs themselves being cardiotoxic drain on that heart muscle. And so this is where we talk about that risk to benefit ratio. Like, I'm going to be dumping more bacteremia into my patient's bloodstream if I'm performing active periodontal therapy on the patient. So that's stressing out the heart muscle. But is it stressing out the heart muscle even more if we don't treat the patient? And the heart muscle is already, of course, stressed out with the use of these medicaments. So this is where, you know, we're so fortunate to have a coordination of care for our patients. When patients are undergoing cancer therapy, that they're seen by a myriad of doctors and clinicians. And I do, of course, believe that the dental healthcare team is a critical aspect of the management of our patients, particularly in optimizing their immune system during cancer therapy. I think this is a critical time for us to be supporting our patients.
And this is where I'm going to tune you into that, our last episode where we talked to Janelle about her active role in treating patients undergoing chemotherapy. She was phenomenal. So I encourage you to listen to our November episode. But on that note too, there's been a lot of research with regards to exercise therapy on patients undergoing chemotherapy or having the side effects of chemotherapy. So exercise has been essential. And this also includes educating your patients on their cholesterol, their blood pressure, glycemic control, and obesity as well to decrease these cardiovascular side effects.
I love that. It really comes down to, you know, prevention. And of course, easier said than done, certainly when an individual is sick in experiencing cancer and sick from the chemotherapeutic agents, but at the same time that there are things that we can do, again, as preventive specialists to encourage our patients to really be supportive for them. Okay. On the third day of Christmas, my patient said they have
chronic kidney disease.
Okay. You didn't sing it. Okay. I understand.
I'm playing with how to present.
Sure. I gotcha. So what do we know about patients that present with chronic kidney disease and their overall risk of cardiovascular or cerebrovascular issues?
So we definitely know patients with chronic kidney disease have a whole host of comorbidities. The kidneys, they're essentially supposed to be ridding our body, and they're supposed to filter our wastes and excess fluid from our blood. We're supposed to be peeing them out. But unfortunately, patients with advanced chronic kidney disease, if we're not able to filter these out, we could get dangerous levels of fluid, electrolytes, and waste buildup throughout our entire body. And kidney disease affects multiple things. It then affects our small blood vessels, which can become calcified. If they affect our electrolytes, that could cause arrhythmias throughout our heart. They also affect our bone reabsorption. They affect multiple things. And then once you're placing a patient on dialysis, well, now you're creating a whole host of problems that can occur. And we know that patients with chronic kidney disease are actually 10 times more likely to have a cardiac event within 5 years of diagnosis.
Wow. Therein lies the issue. It's all connected. And we say that in dentistry all the time, the mouth is connected to the rest of the body, but the kidneys are part of that superhighway system within the circulatory system. And it really becomes critical for us when we talk about a patient who's experiencing a very specific organ system issue, that these are individuals that are also going to be maybe perhaps displaying issues in other organ systems as well. So yeah, it really is incredible. And I think it's vital for us as we look at some of these considerations for our patients, again, to understand if they have chronic kidney disease and they have elevated risk for cardiovascular or stroke risk, what are some of the preventive things that we can do to help these individuals to, you know, manage or mitigate that risk, or at least stop dumping buckets of gasoline on the inflammatory fire for these individuals? And so again, this is where I do believe that dentistry really has a terrific opportunity, you know, to be able to support our patients. Okay. on the fourth day of Christmas, my true love experienced.
I'm going to have to let you do this one because this is your favorite one. Okay.
Erectile dysfunction. Boom. Yes. Erectile dysfunction. I always love to say, you know, when we talk about erectile dysfunction, this, by the way, does affect about 30 million men across the United States. Erectile dysfunction is a clear indicator that there is some sort of a challenge in the microvasculature. And I say this over and over and over again, but the vast majority of the time when a patient is experiencing either cardiovascular risk or a stroke, the vast majority of the time, not always, but the vast majority of the time, the issue is in a microvascular area. It doesn't oftentimes happen in your aorta, in your, you know, your whatever vena cava, your sometimes in the carotids. We can see blockage in those carotids, but more often than not, when we see a cardiovascular event occur in an otherwise asymptomatic patient. So again, this is, think about these are patients that are coming in, sitting down, they're walking around, they got a little bit of hypertension going on, they got some high cholesterol, they're sitting down in your chair, they've got some periodontal inflammation. That's what I'm talking about. These patients that all of a sudden something, you know, catastrophic happens, they have an event, like a cardiovascular event. And these are individuals in which the issue, the source of this cardiovascular atherosclerotic problem is in the microvasculature. So the erectile dysfunction observation is a clear indicator. We understand that erectile dysfunction identifies a clear marker for these microvascular issues. And in fact, patient, I was about to say a male patient, but I think we're all in alignment here. A patient who has erectile dysfunction experiences a doubled risk of a cardiovascular event within the next 4 years when compared with a male patient who does not have erectile dysfunction. So that'll get your patients to perk up and, of course, get very concerned. My hope, of course, being that if we do, and I think this is step number one, if we do feel comfortable enough having this conversation with our patients, I do find that dentistry still, you know, feels quite uncomfortable asking some of these perhaps slightly invasive questions like, do you have HPV? Have you been vaccinated against HPV? Do you have erectile dysfunction? Are fertility issues a concern for you, et cetera? So dentistry does kind of tiptoe on the line with some of these relatively uncomfortable conversations for our patients. But I do want to remind our colleagues listening today that these are questions, albeit perhaps maybe uncomfortable for you, but these are questions that our patients need us to be asking them so that we can better support them in comprehensive levels of care.
Well put. And I think I kind of want to emphasize that actually it has been well documented that erectile dysfunction is a primary indicator. It has been documented a primary indicator of a cardiovascular problem. And yeah, it used to be thought that maybe, you know, there was dysfunction due to plaque buildup or little coagulants in the micro blood vessels, but rather it's a dysfunction of the inner lining of the blood vessels or the endothelium and the smooth muscle in the very small blood vessels. And unfortunately, sometimes this is really the primary indicator when a man says, oh, I have a problem, that really it is an underlying cardiovascular problem. Yeah. And then besides this disease, patients with heart disease also share other many significant risk factors. And this is where we need to talk to our patients about things that may be causing this as well, like their diabetes or tobacco use, alcohol use, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, obesity, low testosterone, yeah, things like that.
Yeah. How incredible. And again, you know, we look at these things and they seem like they're all just sections of the body, just parts of the body that are experiencing this. But when you see how interwoven all of these things are, it really becomes, you know, such an incredible way for us to critically look at our patients, right, which leads us to, on the fifth day of Christmas, my patient said to me,
I have gout. Okay. Monosodium urate elevation. So it's been known that patients who have gout actually have 4 times greater risk of having a cardiovascular episode within 60 days of having an acute flare-up. And this is not something I've actually been talking to my patients about, and I'm going to start. So we know that gout is essentially a buildup of uric acid throughout the body, whether it be that the patient is overproducing it or under excreting it. Most of the time, it's patients who are under excreting it. And we do know that there's a direct correlation between patients who have elevated uric acid and insulin resistance. And there's also an association of patients who have insulin resistance then leading to gout.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying diabetes and gout kind of move in tandem a little bit.
Absolutely. And then of course, all of these things do lead as a risk factor for myocardial infarction or stroke. But then, there are people who live with chronic gout, and then these patients who may have one particular acute gout attack, because they had that heart attack, within a month, they have 4 times a greater risk of having a heart attack.
Wow.
So these people who, they just have a gout attack and they live their life, oh, that's fine. I'll just take colchicine, take this Medrol dose pack, get over this acute gout flare, but then not change their lifestyle. This is where we're seeing huge complications.
So gout, they used to call it like the rich man's disease or something, right? Mm-hmm. Where it was concentrations of what? Like steak and red wine and seafood and like all the good stuff, right? All the yummy stuff. But it's interesting because that the onset of gout comes from that dramatic shift or pivot in diet. And I love that you brought up the dichotomy between acute and chronic gout, because I think this is where sometimes in medicine and in dentistry, we try to do too much in the way of managing some of this for our patients. The reason why the patient is experiencing gout is because of their diet, that their body is beginning to fail them to the point where they've elevated their risk for a cardiovascular or stroke event. And so, again, it comes down to, are we treating the symptoms or are we treating the problem? And, this I think is where we have an opportunity to, really reflect on this and, identify, where we can coach or provide counseling for these patients. All right. On the 6th day of Christmas, my patient said to me, they have
HIV
or
HIV
AIDS.
Or AIDS.
Okay. So what do we know about HIV AIDS patients and their involvement in inflammation and cardiovascular risk?
Yeah, so we do know that about 40 million people are currently living with HIV, and actually 1.8 million become infected every year. With the whole concept of having antiretroviral therapy, it's largely transformed HIV into, instead of acute, a chronic disease. Mm-hmm. So much more people who have HIV or AIDS have been living longer lives. And of course, it's affecting their entire immune system, which has a whole host of complications. But also, these patients who are receiving antiretroviral medication therapy, they do have a significant increased risk for a variety of cardiovascular complications. This could include having an MI, just in general, if affecting the entire heart, which could cause heart failure with both either reduced or preserved ejection fractions or even sudden cardiac death. But then it can also affect the small blood vessels. So certainly can lead to peripheral arterial disease and stroke. So probably most of it is secondary to the complications of patients taking these antiretrovirals.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it shouldn't be understated that these antiretrovirals have really pivoted. There was a time when an HIV diagnosis, certainly an AIDS diagnosis, was a death sentence, for individuals. And now, of course, we call it individuals living with AIDS, individuals living with HIV, because these antiretrovirals have done a terrific job. But the reality becomes, as a dental professional, we see this. We see that patients who are immunocompromised are more prone to oral disease. But what's more, when we see that they're more prone to oral disease and we start to see that development of oral disease again, now we're talking about, perhaps either the condition or the antiretrovirals itself and their oral inflammation, for example, create this really toxic cocktail that ends up rendering or potentially making our patients even sicker. And so this again is where, you know, as we're walking through these conditions, again, you know, I know we're trying to kind of make it fun and holiday themed, but the reality is these are things that your patients are checking on their medical history. And, you know, this is the opportunity for us to expand beyond simply asking for their viral load or their CD4 count and really providing an educational opportunity and saying, I understand that, you know, you're controlling this right now. I'm so glad that your medications are controlling your viral load. The vast majority of my patients who are HIV positive, their viral load is undetectable, which is terrific. That is the ideal outcome for an individual receiving antiretrovirals. However, it is important for our patients to know, because you're on this level of medication and, you know, this medication is doing a great job of controlling your viral load. The other piece of this puzzle is the fact that these medications can elevate your risk for peripheral arterial disease, or, you know, you're elevating your risk of experiencing a myocardial infarction by 50% within 9 years of diagnosis. So this is really where, again, we have the responsibility, the burden of the responsibility to counsel our patients as such. On the seventh day of Christmas, my patient said to me, they have
Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Okay.
Now, Hodgkin's lymphoma is now considered a curable disease with actually a 5-year survival rate of 86%, which is fantastic. And that's really awesome. This is, yeah, if it's caught early enough and treated appropriately, it can have this survival rate. And it's largely due to advances of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So there are certain things that may have consequences of patients who were diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma or are certainly being treated for Hodgkin's lymphoma. One of them could be secondary to just fatigue in general, that the patient's just exhausted. And if the patient's really just not being mobilized, not exercising enough, it can cause for a decreased capacity for physical and mental work in general. And that can certainly lead to cardiovascular dysfunction. Another big cause for this could be increased cardiovascular morbidity and mortality due to we talked about this already, the cardiotoxic effects of the chemotherapy in general. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to cardiovascular disease, ventricular systolic dysfunction, valvular disease, and arrhythmias.
Wow. Yeah, it's just, it's interesting how all of these become contributory factors. And I think all too often, as a dental provider, we're so used to leveraging what the medical community says, which makes sense. I mean, I would certainly never want to interrupt an oncologist's care plan when they're managing somebody with Hodgkin's lymphoma. However, it is important for us to understand, you know, how, again, can we, when we see patients that have these elevated risk pieces, because unfortunately, one of the pieces that we don't look at a lot in research, we're starting to do quite a bit of, is if somebody loses their life to this disease, is it the disease or is it the complications of the disease? When we talk about HIV and AIDS, this is a really great example. I remember learning, like, a patient doesn't die from AIDS. A patient dies from complications of AIDS, from opportunistic infection or some other, you know, modality that, you know, was born of this patient's chronic condition. Mm-hmm. And so again, this is where we look at, yes, Hodgkin's lymphoma can be a treatable disease. The issue becomes if now our amazing oncologists are managing Hodgkin's lymphoma and this patient is now in a state of remission, are we leaving this patient in a state of remission with advanced risk? So this again is where we, based on the work that we are doing in the dental space to manage and reduce cardiovascular risk, can be a supportive layer in this. All right. On the eighth day of Christmas, my patient said to me, they're experiencing
hypothyroidism.
Aren't you so glad that you you have a degree in your undergrad degree is in music?
I'm not a singer though.
I know.
Maybe one of these episodes you can get out your flute and I'll get my clarinet.
Yeah, one of these days we'll have to do that. We apologize to our listeners at home who literally are listening to us sing through this episode.
We apologize for our voices, but we will not apologize for our clarinet and flute duet in the future.
That's right. That spot on. All right. What do we know about hypothyroidism?
Yeah. So the thyroid hormone is very important for the regulation of our body weight, our energy levels, our internal temperature, our skin, hair, nail growth, and our metabolism. So it's a very important function of our endocrine system. And we know that patients who have hypothyroidism may have symptoms like decreased cardiac output or increased systemic vascular resistance, or kind of like we talked about it, it could affect the walls of the arteries. So the walls of the arteries will become hard and thickened and not be able to promote circulation throughout the body. So it can create atherosclerosis. So probably what causes such a huge problem with hypothyroidism is the impaired cardiac muscle not being able to relax. It also causes a decreased heart rate and decreased stroke volume. So there are some significant problems that can occur, especially in the cardiovascular area in patients who have hypothyroidism, along with certain other complications.
Again, to me, it's so wild. The thyroid gland is one that I'm quite, pun intended, I guess, sensitive to, because we know it's a very sensitive gland. I'm very sensitive to it. If I have a patient who comes in and they have a thyroid issue, like I get patients a lot that'll say, I have a thyroid problem and my doctor says no fluoride. I hear that quite a bit. And so for me, it's like, okay, if your doctor says no fluoride, like I am not futzing with that gland. Like we will find another way. We will find another way to remineralize you, et cetera, you know, whatever needs to be done.
Can I ask why?
There are concerns about the buildup of those minerals. There's a lot of, there's a massive document that was done, like hundreds of pages by the ADA that looked at, you know, the different organ systems and fluoride, and does fluoride impact this? Fluoride also has a charge on it. So there are just concerns about what this ultimately would mean for the patients. You know, how would the introduction of fluoride in the patient's body influence the function of this gland that, of course, releases all these really critical hormones?
Wow.
So, you know, again, if a patient says that to me, usually it's my hyperthyroid or my patients that have had like thyroidectomies, either partial or full, that will say that. And it's like, great. I'm not interested in interrupting what you and your physician have to say about that. But when we talk about the risk for cardiovascular event, again, dental professionals, think about this. Patient has periodontal disease. So we know that they have an elevated risk for cardiovascular event and they have hypothyroidism. And now we know that severe hypothyroidism doubles the risk of this patient experiencing a heart attack. The conversation now becomes that in that medical history, we're already doing assessments to evaluate our patient's risk. And this becomes our opportunity to really, you know, partner with our patient's endocrinologist or care management team in helping them. This is what helps us to bridge that gap. All right. On the ninth day of Christmas, my patient said to me, they are experiencing
migraines and headaches.
How frustrating are migraines and headaches, huh? Mm-hmm. Particularly these migraines where you get that aura, right? I mean, you know, it's coming. Here we go. Ready or not, right?
Yeah. And we know that migraines have a huge association with strokes. So let's kind of differentiate what really is the difference. So in a stroke, you actually have a cut off of a blood supply to a certain part of your brain, and it kills the brain cells in that particular area, causing permanent damage. Okay, but migraines actually cause pain and sensory disturbances. So it's more of a neurological problem, and it causes changes inside the brain that are temporary. So you'll experience, you know, that pain, you'll experience that aura or those like bright lights or spots that you may experience. And these have a direct association with each other. So again, they're different, but they have an association, probably because of the
the risk factors that are associated with patients who do get migraines. So a lot of the thing, you know, when you talk about people who get migraines, you talk about different risk factors, like someone who, well, women are very commonly have them. Sometimes it could be due to being on an oral contraceptive pill. It could be due to hormones. It could be due to elevated stress. Other risk factors, like people who smoke, people who drink alcohol, or, and of course we know people who have high blood pressure. And this is where, if we can also talk about other things, high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol as well. So this is where we really need to educate our patients. If patients say, oh, you know, I get migraines all the time. I take a Tylenol and it goes away, or it's fine. Or I just take a nap and it goes away. But this is where we need to talk about certain things that may actually help them, you know, staying hydrated, decreasing your smoking, or smoking cessation, losing weight, exercising, trying to get rid of the daily stress that you have on a daily basis, drinking more water, eating a healthier diet. And this is where we can take an active role talking to our patients, especially if patients are coming to us and not necessarily going to their PCPs.
I almost thought you said, instead of drinking more water, I thought you said drinking more wine. I was like, yeah, that would help. Ay, ay, ay. All right. So here we go. On the 10th day of Christmas, my patient said to me, they're experiencing
obesity. Oh, that worked so well.
Yes. I love that. Okay. It actually rhymed for the first time too, which is really exciting.
I know. That was a lot more fun than most.
I know. Okay. So what do we know about obesity and its overall risk?
Yeah, we know just in general, patients who are obese, they have significant risks. And I feel like this is kind of excessive, but obviously patients who are obese, they're not living the best lifestyle. They're not exercising. They have an elevated risk for having diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. But not only that, these patients who are overeating and have increased lipids throughout their entire body, they do have an overproduction of oxidants. So an overproduction of this reactive oxygen species and reactive nitrogen species, which just overwhelms the body, and it creates this imbalance between these oxidants and these antioxidants. Essentially, the more you're consuming and the more you're not taking care of yourself and having more fat cells throughout your entire body, you're creating a huge system of inflammation throughout your entire body. And although it may seem that you're overconsuming and that your whole body is very healthy, actually your whole body is malnourished, and you need to be getting your, you know, and that's what we talk about in the state of patients with diabetes, that even though they seem like they're overnourished, they're actually extremely malnourished and undernourished.
It is incredible, because that again, kind of leverages a lot of it. I find this amazing. Adipose tissue, fatty tissue, secrete inflammatory cytokines. So when a patient has that buildup of fatty tissue, that adipose tissue, they're releasing things like tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukin-1, interleukin-6, which we know induces those reactive oxidative species. We've seen that there, that association between those reactive oxidative species also demonstrates an increase in C-reactive protein levels. So again, this is where an obese patient is already experiencing a systemic burden of inflammation. And now, you know, we understand that these individuals have an elevated risk for other chronic diseases because their own fat cells are creating more inflammation. So again, when we talk about that inflammatory fire over and over and over again in this episode, not just the fire that we're going to roast our chestnuts on, but making sure that we're doing what we can to put out that inflammatory fire, of course, as much as possible.
I just want to make a note that Katrina was basically born to entertain me. That's why I'm laughing so much. I love this.
Yeah. Mom and dad had you so I'd have an audience. I appreciate that. On the 11th day of Christmas, my patient checked the box in the medical history that they are experiencing
reflux disease. That worked.
I guess we're trying. We're getting there.
No, I think it works.
So this, the 11th day of Christmas, we're talking about reflux disease. What do we know about reflux disease and its influence? Now, and I will say this, hygienists, dentists are taught that reflux disease impacts the quality of the enamel on the teeth. It introduces acid onto the teeth. So I've been trained my entire career to be concerned about reflux, particularly when it comes to decay risk and acid erosion and remineralization therapy and buffering or alkalizing the pH in the oral cavity. That has been consistently our concern. What do we know about reflux disease and systemic disease?
Yeah, I mean, reflux disease is a huge problem. Essentially, what's happening is that your body is overproducing the gastric juices and stomach is not able to hold them down. So they're coming through the esophagus and causing for significant chest pain and reflux. So what do a lot of patients do is they're prescribed, a omeprazole or a proton pump inhibitor. Mm-hmm. And certainly esophageal reflux has a lot of problems associated with it, but probably a lot of the systemic problems could be secondary to just the treatment in general as well. The thing is, and I actually just had a patient, this makes me cringe, but I just had a patient yesterday who said that he takes a proton pump inhibitor daily. And I looked at his chart and he is prescribed to take it for 3 months. Now, proton pump inhibitors are not meant to be prescribed for this long. They're a short treatment. They're only supposed to be prescribed for 2 to 4 weeks. And we know that they have been prescribed much less over the past 6 years or so by providers, but we know that they're readily available in the market. And there's a huge market for it. So patients who experience this problem, what are they going to do? They do the easy thing, you know, oh yeah, that's fine. I'll just buy this medication and take it and solve my problem. But this comes with a whole host of problems. As people who are chronically taking these pills, long-term use of PPIs can cause low magnesium. And if you're not getting your magnesium, this can cause for muscle cramps, dizziness, tremors, abnormal heart rhythms, seizures, and electrolyte abnormalities. It can also decrease your absorption of vitamin B12. And this can lead to macrocytic anemia, therefore leading to cardiac problems and neurological problems. It can also affect your calcium and iron absorption. Mm-hmm. It can, and it's really going to affect your GI pH in general. Your body is supposed to be making these gastric juices to try to break up your food. There's also a significant, and I didn't know about this, but there's a significant drug reaction between PPIs and some anticoagulants you may be taking, like clopidogrel or Plavix. Mm-hmm. So if you're supposed to be taking these for your heart, for your peripheral arterial disease, for the bypass you just had, for the valve that you just had, maybe these proton pump inhibitors that you're taking are affecting that.
It's crazy. And it's interesting, the more that we're studying about reflux disease, to your point, we should not be reducing those gastric juices because then it does impact digestion. And this is where then we start to see, of course, the sequelae of GI disorders forming for our patients. All right. On the 12th day of Christmas, my patient said to me, they are experiencing
rheumatoid arthritis. Rheumatoid arthritis.
All right. All right. Okay. What do we know about RA and its interactive link in advanced risk for systemic diseases elsewhere?
Yeah. So let me talk kind of about the systemic manifestations, and then I want to hear you talk about its association with periodontal disease. So in general, rheumatoid arthritis, the cause is unknown, but it could be genetic. There's a strong genetic predisposition of people who have a certain gene that could have a rheumatoid arthritis. A lot of these patients will experience morning stiffness or joint pain, usually more than one joint, and usually the small joints are affected, such as like the toes and the fingers and the hands. But they do experience a whole host of things. So not only do they have chronic fatigue, but it affects the whole systemic body. So it can cause for dry eyes and the skin. It can cause for rheumatoid nodules or small lumps in the skin over bony areas. It can cause for painful joints, like we talked about, that may be hard for them to exercise. It may be even be difficult. And I talked, I gave actually gave a lecture on rheumatoid foot and ankle surgery. Think about the complications that if I'm going to do a foot and ankle surgery, and now I'm telling my patient who has rheumatoid hands to use crutches or a cane, that's going to be very difficult for them. But not only that, they have problems just in general with the lungs. They have inflammation and scarring throughout their lungs that can lead to shortness of breath and lung disease. It affects their blood vessels, the large blood vessels and the small ones that lead to inflammation, and can also cause damage to the nerves and skin and other organs. They do tend to get anemia, so they'll have lower than average red blood cells, and that's going to affect the healing of multiple parts of the body. It can also affect the heart. So the inflammation that's produced by rheumatoid arthritis can damage the heart muscle and the surrounding areas. It's essentially a mechanism that the body's destroying itself. The immune system is promoting tissue destructive properties to try to destroy itself. And that's where we are trying to have a delicate balance between how to repair the body. So Katrina, tell me about the things that you see in the mouth and from a periodontal perspective in rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah, well, so, and great breakdown of RA. I know we spend, we've got an episode 2 earlier this year that we recorded on arthritis patients and talking about RA. So if this is of an interest to you, check out that episode. But I would say the first thing that we do see quite a bit are just the medications that our patients are on for RA, which, you know, any of these inflammatory inhibitors, we're talking about disease modifying anti-rheumatic drugs. So tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukin 6, these inhibitors to reduce the inflammatory process. So it does impact, of course, the oral cavity for a myriad of reasons. I don't have to tell the dental people that when a patient is on medications that it can cause problems in the mouth. But we absolutely have seen interesting analyses indicating that patients that have rheumatoid arthritis, that we actually could see Porphyromonas gingivalis antibodies as a precursor to RA, which of course is, could be a really scintillating indicator for us. We've also seen that in individuals that have RA, that the amount of periodontal pathogens can be a clear indicator or can give us an idea about the patient's areas of their body where they are experiencing joint pain problems. So one of the things that we ask for with our patients is a DAS 28 score. And the DAS 28 score is a way, it stands for disease activity specificity score. So this is where we ask the patient about what of the 28, you know, most common joints where we'll see RA, what of those joints is has already been impacted or influenced by RA. We've started to see, you know, some correlative studies starting to create some of these links and say, when a patient has a severity of periodontal disease, that they do see a severity of DAS 28 scores. So now we're of course starting to look at, so if a patient has periodontal disease, do those periodontal pathogens, you know, when they travel and they are able to colonize in some of these RA joints, et cetera, you know, what do we really know about periodontal disease and RA? And this is where we're, of course, leveraging the wonderful working relationship that we have with the American Academy of Periodontology and the European Federation workshop to really look at this in greater detail. You know, we mentioned that there are very common risk factors that we do see that are very similar between RA and periodontal disease, like tobacco habits, socioeconomic status, obesity, et cetera. But, you know, again, when we talk about RA, RA is an inflammatory condition. And in fact, you know, one of my favorite pieces of information to provide about RA is that if a patient has rheumatoid arthritis, they have a 45% elevated risk of having a stroke. If a patient has RA and high cholesterol, that elevates their risk of having a cardiovascular event or a stroke by 700%. Wow. So we know that this inflammatory condition certainly drains on our patients' entirety of their, you know, health, their wellness, and their vitality, and ultimately elevates, you know, the risk that these individuals could experience some catastrophic diseases down the road. So with that, okay, let's do the whole thing. Ready? So on the 12th day of Christmas, my patient said to me, 12 rheumatoid arthritis, 11 reflux disease, 10 obesity, 9 migraine headaches, 10 hypothyroidism, 9 Hodgkin's lymphoma,
8
HIV AIDS, 7 gout experiences, 6 erectile dysfunctions, 5 chronic kidney diseases, 4 cancer, chemos, asthma. Wow. How did that happen? How do we go through all of these that quickly? It's like insane. So when we talk about these findings, these 12 conditions, asthma, cancer, chemotherapy, chronic kidney disease, erectile dysfunction, gout, HIV, Hodgkin's, hypothyroidism, migraine headaches, obesity, reflux, RA. When we talk about these conditions that show up in our patient's medical history, that a great way to keep yourself off of Santa's naughty list and onto the nice list is to make sure that we are reviewing these conditions, helping our patients to understand how to protect themselves, and ultimately making sure that we are providing our patients with the best outcomes possible. We are medical and dental providers. Medicine and dentistry should make patients feel better. And that, of course, is the beautiful burden that we hold as medical and dental providers. So,
I love that you said that. Isn't that the goal that we all want? Just to make our patients better.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Absolutely. So on Dasher, on Dancer, on hygienicals and dentists, on podiatrists and cardiologists and endocrinologists, all of us are here pulling Santa's sleigh, helping to provide the gift of health for our patients. Happy holidays to everybody listening to us. Thank you for a wonderful season one of Floss and Flip Flops, produced in partnership with the amazing crew of Dental Products Report and Modern Hygienist. We cannot wait to connect with all of you in season two and beyond. Thank you so much for joining us as we unpacked a year's supply of oral systemic content. Join us next season as we continue to brush up on oral systemic content.
We promise to keep you on your mistletoes.
Oh my gosh, did you just come up with that?
I did. I got it from you.
It's really good. It's really impressive. Well, from our family to yours, be safe, be well, have a terrific holiday season, and a happy new year. Cheers.
Thank you for joining us for another monthly episode of Floss and Flip Flops with the Sanders Sisters.
Thank you for being part of the change we need to see in the medical and dental professions.
Join us next month for another sister-to-sister chat about other unique, interesting, and perhaps provocative and disruptive health topics.
Don't forget to like and subscribe, and maybe even leave a fabulous review.
And we'll catch you next month for another episode of
Floss and Flip Flops
with the Sanders Sisters.
I love you, Kinka.
I love you, Izzy.